Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the session which we have entitled What Goes on Tour? A principle we are about to completely violate. We are meeting today on Kaurna land, and we pay our respects to the attachment to their land of those peoples and to their leaders past and present. There has been for some time an ugly feeling about the Adelaide Writers' Festival that compared to all other writers' festivals in Sydney, in Australia.
Very nice.
It's notoriously discreet. There's been pressure for the last couple of years for more indiscretion, more personal tales of what it is like for people like us to actually go out on the road and labour on your behalf, flogging our books. We've masked some of the unpleasantness. We've swallowed some of our pride. But today is an opportunity for us to speak frankly to Adelaide about the hard lives that we live. And the especially hard lives of the women here to my right, who just keep producing success after success, which only makes life on the road more difficult. I've had about 30 years between books, and I'm not match fit, but they are match fit. At the end of the row, of course, Kate Grenville. And if you haven't read her latest one, read it. And then Una Mannion. From a country of notorious reticence, Ireland. Pip Williams and Susan Johnson. Actually, we're not just going to talk about the hell of literary festivals, but we are also going to be the talk about the hell of just being on the road, trapped on the road with nothing but celebration after celebration to face further down the track. And Kate, I'd like to begin by asking, where do you find the strength to do it?
Well, you know, a signing line is an enormously restoring thing. So thank you all for the signing line this morning. Where do I find the strength to do it? Look, part of it is I wrote a lot of my books when I had two little children, and I had a husband who I was very lucky was prepared to kind of, you know, look after them for a while I went away. So frankly, it was a bit of a sabbatical from being a mum. But please don't tell them that. What goes on tour, etc.
Getting away from your children, if I could put it bluntly.
You want a better answer, don't you?
No, I don't. I don't. I mean, we're here for candour. And honestly,
yeah.
Kate...
Oh, are we?
You represent candour in our literary culture to an extraordinary degree. Una, what's the worst country to try and flog a book in?
I actually have very little experience touring because my first book came out in 2021... and Ireland, at the start of December 2020, had the lowest incidence of COVID in Europe. And the government, because it's very sentimental about Christmas, decided it was really important to have Christmas, to have a meaningful Christmas, to quote the Taoiseach or the Prime Minister. So everything was opened up. And, of course, Ireland, Christmas isn't like a day. It's 2 weeks. It's two solid weeks. And the pubs were open and... There's actually a little town in Mayo called Belmullet, which had the highest incidence of COVID in the world, one in 17 people. People were spilling out of the hotel windows, like on Christmas Eve, because everyone comes home. And by mid-January, we had the highest incidence of COVID in the world. So the government on Christmas Day declared a lockdown. And my book was coming out in January, but in the States it was coming out on the 6th of January, which was the day the Capitol was stormed. So I had a little anxiety about saying, like, yay, me, my, you know, democracy is falling, but, like, I published a book, and then COVID. So I, my book launch, I was in a field on by the sea where at least there was Wi-Fi, I could get Wi-Fi by myself on Zoom.
Yes. Hey, can we all admit as writers what a wonderful time COVID was?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yes, yes, yes.
Ugg Boots, the Ugg Boot, book tour. Yeah.
No obligations, nothing to do but write, which is, can be quite horrifying. Pip, did you flourish in COVID?
I did, really, and my first book tour was a Zoom tour because my first novel, The Dictionary of Lost Words, came out 2 days after we all went into lockdown, when the whole world went into lockdown, just at the end of March 2020. And I just thought it would go quietly to a shelf somewhere and collect dust. But actually what happened was, you know, everyone pivoted to online events. And so I had quite a busy schedule of Zoom events where I would do my hair and my makeup and put on a nice top and have my tracky dacks and my Ugg boots on underneath and hope that, you know, the camera never slipped. And it was really interesting, but I never got signing cues. I never got to... No one picked me up in lifts, which happened this festival.
We'll get to pickups.
I'm calling it a pickup. It might not have been. It just might have been a friendly person. But I did get invited I got a free ticket on the door at a festival show. But that never happened the first
slope.
Year round. I'm being very transparent. My partner is in the audience today, so I'm just, yeah. I said no to the free ticket on the door.
Oh, did you?
So, yeah. Yeah, only because, actually, I was on stage here at the time. I might have gone, actually. I should stop talking now.
I forgot to ask, you were telling us that this little town had the highest rate of COVID in the world. But how were book sales?
So, interestingly, I also thought that the book wouldn't do very well because of COVID, but actually it actually held its own, despite the fact that we were in quite heavy lockdown in Ireland, and there was no bookstores open. There was news agents open. So most of the buying must have happened online, in Ireland anyway.
Mm. 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 Well, Susan, how have you coped with the really harsh circumstances in which you've found yourself over the last few years in relation to literature?
Well, vis-a-vis COVID, I was actually one of the Australians who was locked out of my own country. I couldn't believe, I had a lot of friends who were out of their own countries and their governments were all providing transport back home. But what happened to us is our Prime Minister saw fit to shut the gate, which actually caused an immense grief to many, many families who couldn't get back to see their... You know, I understand we need to protect ourselves from COVID, but I think there should have been some sort of scheme where you could come back in, pay your fees and actually be in quarantine somewhere, personally.
Of course. Yeah.
So for me, I couldn't get back into the country.
Where were you?
I was in Greece at the time because that was my 2 years of being in Greece, and it was a good place to be in lockdown, I have to say. We had to, you know, pretty where we could go. We had restrictions on where we could go, but we could actually leave home for 12 reasons or 6 reasons, I can't remember what, but we'd have to be... I remember I was walking down this absolutely completed deserted road from this ancient Venetian castle down to this very small village of 2 people, and a police car stopped and told me to put on my mask.
In the absolute open air. And I see that you are carrying a mask today.
Oh, yes, I am.
Well, it's in case the security people around here, because... If they don't tell you to take your notebook off the fence, they might tell you to mask up. But let's get to the bottom of this. Did a lot of people buy books during COVID and sit at home and read? Or did they catch up with Netflix? I mean, what... Does anybody know?
Both. I think they did both. I know I had lots of wonderful books delivered to my door by my local bookseller, which was wonderful, and I devoured them because there was nothing else to do. I also watched a lot of Netflix.
Did you get the hint of that, ladies and gentlemen? Nothing else to do but read.
Oh, I know, that sounded terrible, didn't it? Well, my children were older, so I didn't have to homeschool. I have a lot of friends who have smaller children, yeah. And so it was a really vile kind of period of time.
Yeah, it must have been just ghastly. Yeah.
And I did get a little writing done as well. Yeah.
I found there was something about COVID that did something to my brain. And I bought the books.
Did you get it?
No, I still, touch wood, haven't had it.
Oh. That's not wood.
I'm a very small minority. But I bought all the books, and like almost everybody, I set out to read Proust. I, of course, got the Camus, you know, La Peste. Didn't read a word of it. And there's a Dostoevsky book too, I think. So I did all the usual things. I made the determination that I would learn Chinese. Seemed like a great idea at the time. And I did none of those. I read Agatha Christie when I read. I just, something in my brain objected to, I think I was frightened. I think that's actually what was happening. My intellect was kind of paralysed by terror of this thing, because before vaccines, and I'm, you know, a card-carrying old person, there was a very real risk of dying.
Oh, yes.
So I think that affected my, so, yeah, I bought the books. I went that far.
Una, you're nodding. Nodding.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And because of Zoom, I didn't, like, my husband is a musician he plays traditional Irish music, and they tour internationally, and so he was grounded, and the government paid him to be unemployed. But because of Zoom, I was back at work. You know, the country closed on Thursday, and I was back at work on Monday teaching on Zoom. I teach in a third level college, but like Kate was talking about, I found it quite hard to concentrate. So initially, and then Ireland had this incredible, strange spell of 10 weeks of sunshine in April and May of 2020. And I know there was so much suffering in the world, and at the same time, I was in my garden with my kids. All my kids were home, and it was sort of this extraordinary time as well.
I resolved to grow a beard. That was a complete failure, which was embarrassing, even after many, many months. I also resolved to finally finish Volume 3, The Mirror and the Light, and I still haven't been able to finish Volume 3. Volumes 1 and 2 are compelling and wonderful, and I'm scared of Volume 3. But look, what I really want to know about, and I know this is what's brought you under the cover of these trees, is, Susan, the very worst experience you've ever had, either at a literary festival or on the road promoting books, the worst?
Well, the worst is one that I hope never, ever to happen, will ever happen again. I was beginning to tell everybody in the green room about it.
I stopped her.
And he did stop me, so he didn't hear the end. I pride myself on my professionalism. I was a journalist. You know, I meet deadlines. I know where to be at the right place at the right time. David was, in fact, my editor when I was the Queensland correspondent for the National Times. And I never, you know, you never miss deadlines. You do your word count. If you have to go to events like this, you're on time. You go to the green room on time. I've published my first book in 1987, and in fact, this was my first festival in 1987. It was Messages from Chaos, so we're talking like 35 odd years of turning up on time. So what happened was, in 2017 at the Brisbane Festival, I had a session in the morning, and I live in Brisbane, so I went home and I timed it. I thought, well, I can go home and have a a little kip, a little. I'm also of that age where I want to have a nana nap before I, you know, go. So I thought, oh, okay. I set my clock. I was scheduled to do a big international panel. It was the guy who wrote Rich Asians. What's that?
Crazy Rich Asians.
So it was him, and it was a very odd collection of people. It was a very odd panel, and so I had to do a lot of research. And as you know, you prepare things. If you're moderating, you take a lot of time to make sure you know what the questions are, and you don't run out of questions. I'd done all this work. I'd done all the questions to them, emailed them. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I woke up, thought, oh, that's nice, now I'm ready to go. I turned my phone back on, and there was about 25 messages from the festival saying, where are you? You know, you've missed your... I completely got... Somehow, it was something to do with... I have no idea to this day what happened. I had a conniption. And then I thought, oh, my God, I felt like dropping dead. They were on the... Luckily, because I had prepared so well, I'd sent all the questions ahead to the to all the members, and they'd given all the... luckily, to four of them. And so someone had been able to step in and read my questions.
Oh, my gosh.
And ever
I'm
since...
I'm surprised that you're here today.
Well, I was just going to say...
Further invitations
and
followed.
I was going to say, I had to tell Zoe, who was... Zoe, luckily, was the daughter. I was so old. It was actually the daughter of someone I used to work with at the Sydney Morning Herald, Deborah Jobson's daughter, Zoe.
Oh, yes.
Who was the festival organiser. And I said to her, I am mortified. This has never, ever happened to me in my whole life. How can I ever make it up? And so she put me on a few more sessions. And then when I was on... at the Byron Bay, she later became the director of the Byron Bay Festival. And all festivals have people that fall out like this, where we've planned another one. So she got me to do three extra sessions, and she said, you owe me.
Absolutely fair enough. OK, Pip.
Well, probably I have two stories, and they both happen in Margaret River. And Margaret River was actually the very first festival that I did for the Dictionary of Lost Words. So it was a good sort of 18 months, I think, after the book had been published. But it was the first time I had a face-to-face. And for whatever reason, I was put in the same house as various Australian luminaries and celebrities. And we realised, I was with my partner, and we were told who else was in the house, and we bunkered down in the room for a little while, trying to figure out how we would cope with being in the house with all of these people, which included Bob Brown, Julia Baird, Jane Caro, Jonica Newby from Catalyst and her husband Robin Williams, and us. And I had never... I hadn't been to a festival for that book. I don't think I'd even been at a festival before. And we have no idea why we were put in this house. And it was a share house, essentially. It was massive and beautiful and resort-like, but we had to share the kitchen and the living space and so on.
With Bob
and
Brown.
And we talked about... the bathroom? We didn't have to share the bathroom. We did talk about perhaps just staying in the bedroom and not leaving except for my sessions, but we eventually went out, and I practiced the names because I'm actually really bad with names. And so I was practicing the names, and we went out and we met various people. I was great. I said, Bob Brown. I remembered Julia Baird. And then I went, oh, hello, Caro. And she just looked at me and she said, it's Jane. And I know that. And then as soon as I could, went back to my bedroom, and I'm not sure I came out when there was people in the common area. That was one. And then the other one happened in Margaret River as well. It wasn't a festival. It was pre-Margaret River Festival 2 years later. And we were in our hotel room, and I was getting ready for, you know, to go out, and I ran to the bathroom and kicked the thing that you put your luggage on, you know, the thing that folds out and you put your luggage on, and my toe wrapped around it and broke. And that was the beginning of quite a lengthy book tour, which for the rest of the book tour I was sort of on crutches. But, yeah, so they're the worst things.
Oh. Must make you just want to come back and back, back and back. Una, come on.
When my first book came out, it was nominated for a prize at a festival in Ireland called the Docky Prize. And so we were lining up to go in to, for the prize announcement, which I did not win, but we were lining up, and it was an area all full of gravel, and someone was coming in a wheelchair, and the wheelchair got stuck in the gravel, and because it's just, I think if something is happening to anybody, it's my responsibility, even though I was queued up to go onto the, you know, into the room. So, and I was wearing a dark green dress, and I got on the ground, and I was trying to dig out the stones around the wheels, but somebody else was trying to pull it, the wheelchair back. And then I touched the chair. I know you're not, so, like, I shouldn't have touched the person's chair, and someone said to me, don't touch the chair. And I was like, I know. And then I started to cry. And I look up, and I'm splayed on the in the gravel, and Bono is sitting there, and Sally Rooney is the other side. They're all looking at me like, what? I'm sitting on the ground in the gravel, crying. And so, yeah, and that night, Sally Rooney drove me home, actually, because she's with Faber, and Faber organized a dinner at the festival for... that was drum band for people who'd got favorite writers who'd been nominated. So Sally Rooney and her husband and John Banville were there. But Sally Rooney and her husband are very responsible, and they drove me home back to the hotel because we all had drinks. They didn't.
A little pastoral care. Yeah. You all need it.
Kate, I'm hoping you can do better than that. I mean, that is a touching story of very, very good behaviour, which goes a little bit wrong.
Yeah.
I'm hoping for something that begins with malice. Can you help us there?
Well, no, I can't oblige with that, but I would like to start. You know, when you asked me, where do you find the strength to keep doing that? It completely threw me, because I expected you to say, what is the worst experience you've had on tour? Easy.
I was holding that up my sleeve.
Which I will. And so I gave an answer that I very much regret. I didn't really go on tour to get away from my children. In fact, on tour, I wasted my time on tour, because I missed them so much. I moped around. I went through the incredible procedure that you had to do in those days to call internationally, and these frighteningly expensive phone calls with my little children, long silences from their end, you know. Anyway, I want to apologise for that and to say that you caught me off guard, and I said something that actually isn't true, which is appropriate for this thing.
Canada,
the real reason... Now that I've had a chance to kind of think about it, sorry, did you want to say something?
I was just mocking you. Yes, go on.
Look, the real reason, I think, is that nothing exceeded my very, very first public reading for sheer mortification. After that, it's actually been fairly easy. I had just written some short stories which were published in a book called Bearded Ladies, and it was published by UQP, and there was a reading outside the UQP offices, which is on campus at UQP. So it was a beautiful green, very green, I should have known, suspiciously green, grassy sward. Now, it was my first reading, and I didn't know that it's kind of cool not to dress up too much. And also, I was young and, you know, wanted to look gorgeous. So I wore sort of 4-inch stilettos. And you can probably see where this might be going. And I had a story that probably took 6 or 7 minutes to read. And when I had finally finished it, I could feel something happening in the vicinity of my heels. But by the time I had finished it, I was absolutely pinned to the spot by my stilettos. And I seem to remember David Maloof, what a gentleman, coming forward very nicely and kind of actually dragging me out like something like a quick kid. So it's all been uphill since then, downhill. It's all been good since then.
I don't know whether any of you people know the town of Timaru in New Zealand, but I found myself there in about 1994, 95, something like that. And I was on a tour flogging the letters of Patrick White. Now, the appetite in New Zealand for the letters of Patrick White wasn't incredibly strong, but there, everywhere where we had been, there was a nice turnout in a bookshop, and, you know, a good time was had by all, and I exercised, I enjoyed myself talking and that kind of thing. People were very polite. The bookshop in Timaru, I arrived at, you know, half an hour before the session was to start, and there was a table with about 100 glasses on it. There was a bar with, you know, buckets of ice and bottles in the ice, and there were plates of hors d'oeuvres. It was a big event. And four people came. And I thought, you know, what do you do under these circumstances? And I had an inspiration. I said, let's all go and have dinner. And we did. And it was the most fabulous night because two of the four were lawyers and they knew each other. And most of the conversation that night, and this did relate to Patrick White, who had a fascination with the horribleness of murder in New Zealand. And these guys were criminal lawyers, and they talked, again, they just told story after story of the stupidity of their clients. I mean, he lived on a farm. He should have known you had to slake the body with lime, but did he? No. Or another story I can't get out of my head was, drove the body through town without the tarpaulin tied down and the tarp blew off. It was the most wonderful night, just talking about the sheer stupidity of New Zealand murderers. Heaven, really. That was my worst experience. But what about...
That sounds like a great experience. Yeah.
It was. It was. But I tell you, there is something about standing there and a couple of people come into the bookshop, and you wait for some more people to come into the bookshop, and you look at the clock, and yes, one more person does come into the bookshop, but there's no sign of a late rush coming into the bookshop, and there was the reproach of those glasses. I can see them still. All of those wine glasses, my God. But, you know, we rescued it, but it was pretty terrible. It was pretty terrible.
Can I just say, for every writer like me who's not a bestseller, I've sat next to Pip at a book signing, and Pip's book signing went like mild, and I was there going, and I had about one person who said, oh, I read your book. You know, I can't remember what was that book? I mean, and I said, I don't know which one was it, and there was so I think that happens a lot. I mean, all of us would have.
Yes.
You got. I have stories like that because I'm not like you. Like, you know, I don't sell that many, so I've got lots of stories where, you know, and I know many friends like me who don't sell that many, who also have been at book signings where, you know, really. You might get your, you know, a family friend or something like that.
Well, that's what publicists are for, actually.
Yeah.
A good publicist will stand beside you, and as she sees the line shrinking, it's usually a she sees the line shrinking, she suddenly thinks of some extraordinarily interesting and important thing that she needs to talk to you about. So you get engaged in... So you then spend a very long time with the very last person in the queue, assuming there has been any queue at all. You talk to them about their lives and their greyhounds and all the rest of it. You sign their book at some length very slowly, hoping that someone will turn up. And finally, you and the publicist get lost in... Those bookshop events, the wonderful thing is that they, unless it's just me not being invited to them, they don't seem to happen anymore. I think booksellers... I had one.
Oh no, they still have them occasionally.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Oh God, maybe I just.
I think all the bookshops are too small to host you.
Possibly,
is maybe the problem.
No. But
she's a traffic hazard.
Yeah.
I mean, Kate, I saw it this morning. There was a poor North American author sitting beside me at the signing table. My cue came back almost to the stage from over there.
Is that true?
He had, as far as I can see, one customer. I mean, what do you do? Yep. Do you engage?
Yep.
Oh, do you... did you come back twice to help him out? All right. No, I didn't know what to do. I mean, do you engage him in conversation? Do you talk about the fickleness of fame? There really aren't subjects for conversation that you can properly raise under those circumstances. I was terribly nervous about the whole thing. He's going to go back home with a terrible view of Adelaide, talking about the heat and you know, the levels of literacy. What?
She said, yeah.
Oh, marvellous, marvellous, marvellous. Talk about the other books he's written. Fantastic. No, that's a very good, that's a very good idea.
Yeah. I just want to say to Susan, I've been very lucky with signing cues, and I think it's partly because of the COVID thing. It sort of created a build-up, a backlog of, yes, of people who wanted,
well,
their books.
Well, that's very kind, but I know you've sold many, many, many books.
However, it's a very grounding experience to be at an event with Marcus Zusak. So I think any one of us could be at an event with Marcus, and you're feeling quite confident with the length of your queue, and then it eventually peters out, and you realise that Marcus's queue,
yes,
is going to continue for another 3 hours unless someone intervenes.
Yes. Yes.
So
yes,
it's quite grounding if ever you're starting to think too much of yourself.
When you're doing a session and they say to you, "Are you signing too?" I always say no, and I think that's the best course.
Yeah.
No, just simply no. Can we talk about a difficult issue, and only difficult issues are truly interesting, and that is alcohol and book festivals, alcohol and promoting books on the road. And Una, perhaps you look suddenly...
Because I'm Irish.
No.
You look like you've drunk a bit
you
of alcohol
suddenly
in your time.
Yeah, there's been, like in Ireland, there's been a few really, really high-profile cases in the last few years around this issue where women have spoken out about things that happened at book festivals or book tours, and it's kind of... So, yeah, and alcohol is often part of it. And there's... you know, there's a part of me that, you know, like, people need, you know, to be behaved, but also I feel like I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but I also think that when there's all adults in the room and that people also can be responsible for themselves, there's a bit of me that worries that there'll be no more fun at all. but that's not to say... Because I think one of the things that the cases have highlighted is sometimes that, you know, that when there's huge like power differentials or, you know, how that feels for some people. So yeah, I'd personally I so far hopefully maintained my dignity, I think, ish.
I wonder if festivals are they places where sort of elderly literary figures behave badly after they've had about 16 drinks? I suppose it could happen. No one's ever behaved badly with me, but
well, I think you see it all the time, and not just at book festivals. I think that there's a lot of people who behave badly after a few drinks. And I don't want to make it generational, but it does sometimes feel like men of a certain generation still have a different, I don't know, sense of what's appropriate or not. Is that fair?
It's a present company accepted, of course.
Yeah, but Kate and I were briefly talked about how the changes in, you know, in the 80s, everyone drank and smoked. You know, and there was much more, I think there was much worse behaviour, and I think we all remember, you know, being young women in that environment. It was very tricky, it really was. You know, I used to feel very intimidated, but it was much more blokey and, you know, there was just much more alcohol, you know, around.
It was more blokey, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely
and,
more blokey.
And one of the attractions of the Adelaide Festival was that you could smoke. You know,
I don't remember that. Was that...
The Writers' Festival. I mean, you could sit there and smoke.
Wait. Was that the only one?
Ladies and gentlemen, I know you're proud of your town, but I'm here to tell you something. There was a lot of smoking in Adelaide. it went on for a long time. On the drink question, are you as amazed as I am that wherever you go in the world, the white wine served at book do's tastes exactly the same? Is there an explanation for this?
I haven't noticed that. But can I just say, though, about the drinking? I'm just going to turn it slightly. I wasn't around in the 70s and 80s or 90s, or actually the noughties, as far as festivals were concerned. I was around, but not at festivals. But one of the things about socialising at a writer's festival, and this has been my experience, is I wasn't part of a writing network particularly when I wrote my first book. And because my first book came out into COVID, I didn't get to socialise with writers until a good deal of time later. And I'm quite introverted and find the social scene, perhaps, of festivals a little intimidating. But what's been really wonderful is meeting writers who take you under their wing. And I've met a few of those. Kate Mildenhall, who was here, is one of those. She's one of those wonderful extroverted writers. And I think extroverted writers are rarer than introverted writers. And there's a few like that. And they make sure that you're invited to a dinner that might be happening, or you're invited to drinks, or whatever it might be. And that actually makes the festival experience really enjoyable. Otherwise, I would be going back to my hotel room and ordering room service and watching Netflix, because I might not have the confidence to just wander into an already established group. And there's a lot of established groups at writers' festivals.
Yeah, yeah. But they're places where we make friends for life.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. And maybe the drinking thing could also be exacerbated by the introversion thing, because alcohol gives you a sense of confidence that you might not already have.
So. Exactly. My thinking, listening to all this, is I made a big mistake in not getting drunk at these festivals. I would have had a much better time, particularly during some, you know, gruesome, long, serious panel discussions about things. I would have had a far better time if I'd been drunk as a skunk. I'll learn. Is it too late? No, it's not. Is it? Not too late. No.
Have any of you written about literary festivals or written about flogging books on the road in your own work? Has it featured at all?
No, not for me.
No.
I mean, wouldn't we be libelled? I mean, wouldn't we be, you know...
I haven't either. I don't think... Oh, no, I have reported a few literary festivals, I suppose. But you see, this is an undiscovered subject where a great deal of damage could be done by any of you looking along that line. Yes. Serious damage.
I think one of the nicest things, though, about festivals, and it's, again, because I missed out on it for a long time, is actually all of you. So meeting... Kate alluded to it earlier, but meeting people in the signing queue who have... Mm-hmm. read and enjoyed your book is such a privilege, and for so many reasons you couldn't necessarily anticipate. I don't know if he's still here, but I had this beautiful young man come up in the signing queue earlier, and there's he actually, I have to admit, I'm not sure he had read the book, but he'd seen the play. and he said
enough.
Seeing the play, you know, was a turning point, changed his life. And he's at NIDA, so he's interested in theatre. And then he didn't have a book with him, so I was curious about why he was in the queue. And then he said, "Do you mind signing my chest?" Did I mention he was absolutely gorgeous? And so then he pulled his shirt open and I had to say, oh, you know, because I had to steady my hand. So I asked for consent. I said, am I allowed to touch? And oh, yeah. And so I signed his chest and then I asked him his name, and I'm really bad with names. So I wrote his name on my wrist, and it's faded because I went to the pool this afternoon. His name was Otto.
Oh,
and it was a really lovely moment. And it's not the first kind of ink moment I've had with someone who's read my book. Another one was really lovely, actually. Someone on Instagram, I'm not on Instagram, but someone had shown me this. Someone on Instagram had tattooed Esme, who's the main character in my first book, on her wrist, which was just amazing. And then 2 years later, when I published Bookbinder and I was finally allowed to meet audiences, a young woman was the last person in the signing queue, and she arrived and she handed over Bookbinder, and I saw the tattoo on her wrist.
Oh, wow.
And I asked her about it, whether she'd put it on Instagram, and it was the same woman. And she, and I'm waiting for her to put Peggy on the other side, but, you know, that might not happen. But, you know, that's kind of mind-blowing that someone, that something you've written has meant so much to somebody that they're willing to live with it for the rest of their life.
And so you got Otto's phone number.
No, just his name. And also, my name's going to wear off his chest, so...
Not if he takes certain precautions. What do you do in a signing queue when somebody comes up to you with a broad smile on their face and you have no idea what their name is? Mm-hmm. Just no idea. Mm-hmm. What do you do? Kate?
Look, I have this whole riff about prosopagnosia. And that shuts them right up. I say, I'm really sorry, I don't recognise... In fact, it's kind of true. I don't recognise... I know you, but I don't know who you are, and that's because I have this medical condition called prosopagnosia. And the shutters kind of come down. In fact, prosopagnosia, as some of you probably know, has anybody in this audience got prosopagnosia? It's... Yes, there you go. There's a couple in every crowd. It's face blindness. It's what Oliver Sacks had. You find it very difficult to recognise whether a face is familiar to you. It's not even that you can't put a name to it. So, as you can imagine, I have left a trail of offended people through my life when I'll meet somebody at some... I used to think, you know, it was bad that I wasn't able to do the networking that people do because book launches always seem to be at a child-unfriendly time of day. But actually, when I went to them... I knew that I was doing myself more harm than good because I would see somebody. They would come up to me and say, hello. And they'd introduce themselves. And I'd say, terribly nice to meet you. And they said, no, but we've met before many times. Anyway, where did the prosopagnosia story go? I can tell you it's a good way to kind of silence them. But when you were speaking, Pip, I did have a really nice memory. It happened here. And I had done a book about fragrance, which is The Case Against Fragrance, it's called. Now, my publisher didn't want to publish that book, and he tried to talk me out of it by saying, Kate, for you to write a book about fragrance, you know, a sort of scientific book about fragrance, would be like Mozart giving up symphonies and taking up greyhound racing. So I told this story at this very festival, and in the signing line... was a woman who said, look, as it happens, I'm a greyhound trainer. And we had a very good correspondence since then about greyhound training. So it can work out.
And what's your secret?
Secret to...
They're coming down the queue. Five or six away. You've known this woman for 30 or 40 years. You have no idea what her name is, and she's smiling broadly.
So what happens to me is that I'm always the person that remembers everyone.
Oh, wow.
And often will be like, oh, hi, you know, and they're like, they don't remember me. Yeah. So I haven't really had that experience, except last week I was on Friday night, I was in Ennis, which is just outside Limerick at the Ennis Book Club Festival, and I had been Facebook messaging with this woman. She's my Facebook friend, and she was coming to the festival. And very rare moment where she came. She was in the signing queue, and she's like, and she said her full name. I won't say it, but she said her full name. And then I just didn't. I was like, oh, do you want me to sign it? You know, and I'd signed the book, and I was driving up to Dublin then to get the flight here, and I realized while we were driving
suddenly
that I had completely, like, not only had she given her full name, and that was, it was unlike me, but I Facebook messaged her and all good. And I want to say I've never had any experience like Otto, or that has just never happened to me.
You've got something to look forward to.
In any kind of incarnation in my life. Yeah. Wow.
So, Pip, what's your specialty?
Well, I think a bit like Kate, I'm dyslexic. So this happens
constantly, especially in Adelaide, where I used to work for Adelaide City Council. I've had jobs here. I know a lot of people from the years that I've lived here. And I have always been really terrible with names, and I apologise to anyone who is here whose name I've forgotten over the years. But I think I probably make the mistake of trying to convince people I do remember their name. But because I'm dyslexic, I always say, oh, look, I still need you to write your name down because of, you know, I don't want to misspell it. Oh. And so they'll do that, and I'll realise the name was Jan.
Oh, yes.
Or Sue, or something equally easy that even I can spell.
Yes, how do you
and
spell your name?
It's a dead giveaway. Tim. I had no idea what their name was, yeah.
Yes.
But that's what I do too. I get around it by asking how I spell it, you know.
And they say Tim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work all the time.
Is
but
that
I
the usual spelling with one M or two?
Yeah.
No.
But what publicists do these days, and this must happen to you guys.
Stand in the queue.
Now, and they'll stand in the queue and do a forward run and get the names, and then by the time the book comes, it's got a yellow post-it note with the name on it. Yeah. But you've got to have a publicist, you've got to have big queues for that. I don't get that.
And you've got to have a publicist who can say, I know you say he's your brother, but still, every name has to be on a post-it note, that kind of thing. But it's the sweetness of people who put up with our forgetfulness that I find so incredibly touching. Mm. And, of course, when you're in another town, suddenly somebody comes up out of the crowd and it's a very familiar face and you think, oh, this is a cousin of mine. What's her name? And family's particularly forgiving along those lines. Particularly for giving. Hey, look, talking about lines, if anybody would like to ask these people a question on any subject, I don't want the questions to be on anything more intellectually taxing than the kinds of things we've been talking about already. Though I think you're astute enough to understand that in our light-hearted banter, a great deal of wisdom has been expressed. Oh, good, there are some questions there. Why don't I hand over to her?
Hello.
Hello.
I'd like to ask people on the panel where they'd like to go for a literary event, whether there's a particular festival they'd like to go to or some site to launch a book. And I just might mention I come from Darwin and we have a very nice little literary festival in the Northern Territory that often knows between Alice Springs and Darwin.
I have been to the Darwin Festival several times and I've loved it. Aww. So invite me again.
Aren't little festivals wonderful? Mm-hmm. I mean, Darwin, I know, is not tiny. But Sebastian and I were recently at the festival at Tathra, and there on the far south coast of New South Wales, one of those festivals where you're all in it all together for 2 or 3 days and you're all eating together, and this is, you know, writers and crowd, you're all eating together and drinking and having a good time. It's really, really wonderful. But, you know, what's the
This, Adelaide, this is for me, I've come across what was my first long-haul flight. I've never, ever been to an event where there's, it's so supported, it's so beautiful, though it's been raining for four, it's been raining since October. So thank you so much, Adelaide.
I have to admit, I actually love Adelaide too. So I moved here 20 years ago and I've been coming to this festival every year since I moved here. And I think it is the best festival in the country, particularly among the big festivals because it's free. There's such good access. But
yes, yes.
You mentioned the small festivals. They are really special. And I've been to a lot of small festivals in the last 18 months. And I love them for all those reasons. You get to spend a lot of time with the other writers. There's not too many of you, and you also get to spend quite a lot of time with the readers. So it's just, it's lovely. And you get to see a part of the country you might not otherwise go to.
Yeah, I think that's right. And small country towns, you know, that don't get a lot of things, they're really, really grateful. Mm. And so it's wonderful that you can get to mix with local people. I've been to one in Queensland that, like, it was in Dalby, which is like a long way out, and there was a far western one as well. And Mudgee's really great. All the small festivals are just really delightful.
Scone is lovely. Scone is terrific.
Yeah.
You bet. Well, it's Patrick White territory, of course.
Yes, of course.
You'd understand that.
Yes.
Do you know I spent about 2 years, when I was working on Patrick White's life, I spent about 2 years trying to prove that his family killed blacks. I really wanted to prove that the White family killed blacks. And from beyond the grave, I can hear Patrick White's raucous laughter that it was his biographer's family that was killing blacks. Another question.
Hello. Thank you for your session. This question goes to moral standards. Now, I've been coming to Writers' Weeks for many, many years, and in the days before mobile phones or the internet or any of that, maybe the 80s, I do recall reading in one of the local papers a small advertisement at the beginning of Writers' Week that more or less said that a really good writer was looking for sexual favours for a week. No kidding.
What?
I did not answer it. I thought, how amazing. I don't know if anyone here did answer this advertisement, but I definitely saw it in the Adelaide paper.
Are you asking if it was one of us?
No. What I'm asking is, does this still go on?
Who was it? Faye Weldon.
It was a man.
An ad by Faye Weldon?
It was a man looking for a woman, I've got to tell you.
But look, once again, it goes to the power of classified advertising. It was the way in which newspapers were once kept afloat. Now there's probably an app somewhere which says Fest Sex.
Well, that does sound like something that Faye Weldon would do. It does. It does say sound like something. But we were actually talking before about, as well, the numbers of sexual relationships and liaisons and the, you know, people who've left their marriages for other people. We all know stories like that, and we've just said, obviously, we can't name any names.
No.
But there are many, many stories of, you know, both inappropriate advances. Louise Adler was telling about, there's a very famous person who shall go nameless, who was absolutely renowned for being a sexual pest, a male in this case, absolute sexual pest. And, you know, that did used to happen, but, you know, you can't name any names, but you know, I know people who've... I do know one person who left a marriage because there was another person. I mean, they started an affair here, and then they ended up living together. So there are lots of things that go on behind that, but you can't.
But this is Hobart. His name was Richard. He was actually a publicist. He was my publicist actually, but he didn't leave a marriage. But he. He was straight when he flew into Hobart. And we were together for a few years, you know, that sort of thing. Yes, question.
Thank you. I wanted to just perhaps draw a parallel from this great cultural event to that other great cultural event, the Matildas versus Uzbekistan in Melbourne last week. And just wondering whether there is some way in which the person... with the American writer with only one person in his queue could take heart in the way that Uzbekistan could take heart in being beaten 10-0 but having a great learning experience, and that on your trajectory into international fame you have to actually go through these sort of drubbings. Thoughts?
My son is a coach of an under-12 soccer team. And over the years, there's been times when his soccer team or the other soccer team has been beaten 10-0. And really, it could have been 11-0 and a writer could have sold no books. So it's kind of, you know, there's not a lot more you can say.
Well, I mean, Uzbekistan had what Peter Dutton would call a moral victory. It's where you lose. Sorry, you were about to speak.
No. I can't. No. Can we just say how? No, I'm not going to say anything else.
Question.
Hi. I am actually someone who has not read Dictionary of Lost Words but has seen the play and loved the play, and I wanted to ask I will go. I'll go. Definitely go. I will read it.
You're not,
I promise.
You're not Otto, are you? No.
I could be. It's like
I can see from here he's not Otto.
Thank you. I have so many names, but who knows? Look, I just wanted to ask, what was the relationship like with Verity Lawton? How? Because I watched it as a complete work. I'm like, wow, this is a wonderful world to be in. It's like some of the best work I've seen Verity do. And like Tilly was wonderful. My friend Rachel, brilliant, right? So watching that, I wanted to ask you. Where was that line without knowing where the novel was?
Yeah, actually, it's lovely speaking to people who haven't read the book but have seen the play, because the play, what it tells me is that the play is, it's a product all of its own, because people have really engaged with the play without knowing the book. There was always a fear that it would be just filled with book club goers who've loved the book and, you know, want to see it just transformed on stage. But it's nice to know that it has translated into a story in and of itself. And the relationship between me and Verity, it's Verity's, that is Verity's creative piece, not mine. Of course, she read the book and we talked, but really I had nothing to do with the play in any way in terms of its creative content. She really managed somehow to put a 100-year time span into 2.5 hours and to make all of those time transitions. And what was wonderful is that writing, as we all know, is such an isolated... And Kate could talk about this as well. It's such a solitary act. And I don't collaborate until the editing process, and then it's only with one person. And it's in the safety of no one else listening. Putting a play on is quite different. It's very collaborative. It's very challenging, I think, for the playwright, because the play is workshopped with actors and so on, and everyone's criticising it and putting their two bits in. But it also only comes together if the director and the stage designer and the music and the lighting are all working in the same space. And... yeah, I am so happy with the outcome of that play. I feel very proud to be attached to it, but I feel very grateful to Verity and Jessica Arthur, yeah.
Mm. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming into the shade and having a quiet time with us while we have a bit of a gossip and a chat and a reflection with these fine writers, Susan Johnson, Pip Williams, Una Mannion and Kate Brendel.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. You.